Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention? And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
This is Radio Influence. The future is now.
He got him in the white trunks. He hurt him.
That's beautiful.
Oh, God.
That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he forced the top.
Wow.
And here's Lucas Amici. And it's all over. It's
nice.
All over. First round knockout.
Big
he's out. Rich
one
Franklin
punch
retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen, happened.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
Welcome to the October 24th edition of the MMA Report podcast with Dale Galvan. I am Jason Floyd. Come up here on this week's edition of the podcast to give you a little nugget about Bellator 207. We'll talk about Conor McGregor's Instagram posts about his thoughts about his fight with Khabib Nurmagomedov. We'll recap PFL 10. We'll preview Saturday's UFC Fight Night card. Plus, we're going to talk about a tweet that Ben Askren had to say. Plus, going to have interviews with Andre Sukumtha, Lewis Smolka, Weston Wilson, and Hillary Rose. But Dan, I want to start off the show with a little bit of a minor nugget. Tuesday is typically my day where I start making my phone calls about trying to find out things for us to talk about here on the podcast. And I knew that the drug test results were likely in for Bellator 207. Of course, that was the event headlined by Matt Mitrione and Ryan Bader, and confirmed with Mike Mazzulli that the no positive drug tests, all the drug tests came back negative. Also, he did let me know about the medical suspensions for the fight card, Baby Slice. He got a 90-day suspension. He will need clearance from a lab report to come off suspension. Roy Nelson, he got 60 days. He will need a neurological clearance to come off suspension. Carrington Banks, he got a 90-day suspension. He'll need an MRI and a neurological clearance as well. Of course, we all remember that brutal knockout that he suffered in that fight. So I want to kind of kick off the show with a little bit of news there.
Yeah, and nothing too surprising there. It's one of those things where moving forward, there isn't any medical suspension that jeopardizes any of the interesting things Bellator's got planned. But yeah, all those make a lot of sense. I mean, these are some guys, Nelson and Kevin Ferguson specifically, and Banks, with the way he – you got to imagine the knockout with the knee, all deserving of medical suspension to let those guys recuperate and recover. And good to get that out there. And you look at the damage those guys took, and the fact that you got to think Derek Lewis took similar damage despite not being knocked out, and he's actually fighting not too far away in the future after his fight where he got completely dominated by Alexander Volkov. So I think that's an interesting thing to bring up as we cover these medical suspensions.
Yeah, that is kind of the crazy thing. I mean, I didn't realize this till about an hour before we started taping. You realize UFC 230 is next week?
I kind of realized it just in that every single week, whenever there was a fight announcement or a fight injury, like Luke Rockhold pulled out, it's like, yeah, guys, this is coming up. Yeah, this is coming up. This is coming up. And it's next week. And this, man, Daniel Cormier is one of the biggest. He's a legend in the UFC at this point with what he has accomplished in his career. But if you're the UFC, you want this to be the worst buy rate you've ever done in Madison Square Garden, because they were caught with their pants around their legs this time around. There was no preparation. I mean, they announced Eubanks and Shevchenko as their main events, and they had to settle for Cormier versus Lewis. This thing came up soon. And just to, again, like Derek Lewis, I believe, set the record for significant strike disparity or something like that in a victory? It was something of the nature in which it's not a stat you want to hold a record of despite winning. But it was along the lines of Alexander Volkov absolutely beat the crap out of Derek Lewis, but Derek Lewis still won. And the last UFC event featured Derek Lewis on it, getting hit in the head repeatedly. And two UFC events later, we're going to see him at UFC 230. But yeah, I tell you what, it really did come up out of nowhere. It came up incredibly quick.
Yeah, I also saw Daniel Cormier. He spoke with the media last week and already kind of noting, hey guys, if somehow I don't walk away as a heavyweight champion, doesn't mean I'm quite giving up my light heavyweight belt, which of course we all know. Basically, once the first punch is thrown in, John Jones and Alexander Gustafsson, he's been stripped of the title. But I did see this tweet on Tuesday in relation to UFC 230, and it was from Josh Thompson. Of course, we all know Josh trains out of AKA there. He hasn't quite called it a career yet, but he quoted a tweet from Crooklyn where Stephanie had wrote, Kane has left the building. And this was Josh Thompson's response. I don't know if you saw this. He said, everyone needs to ask the UFC why Cain Velasquez isn't back. Let's not beat around the bush anymore with this, and let's be honest. The UFC heavyweight division needs him, but they are BSing with this dude. Daniel Cormier won't be around to keep saving their shows. Very interesting tweet from a fighter out of the AKA gym.
I don't understand. Are they just not responding to Cain Velasquez's text messages? Are they leaving Cain on red? If you're in the UFC, this is kind of crazy because, again, Cain Velasquez may not be the money star of Brock Lesnar, but for the love of God, he's a significant star. He's a heavyweight champion. He's the guy you put on Fox. And, I mean, what are we reading between the lines here, Jason? Are we saying that the UFC is waiting to put Kane in the heavyweight title picture or put him in a fight like that until after the Brock Lesnar situation is done with Cormier?
The way I kind of take that is it seems like Kane's ready to go and the UFC's not giving him a fight offer, but I don't – that's just me pure speculating more than anything else. But, man, it'd be great to have Kane back in there. I mean, obviously we know all the injury situations he's had to deal with.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, you don't have to play conspiracy theory and think that – Kane didn't get this fight with Cormier. Let's say if he was hypothetically ready, which who knows? Kane didn't get this fight with Cormier because he might beat Cormier. There's a real big chance. Whereas Derek Lewis, there's obviously a chance. I mean, this guy hit so effing hard. I mean, if we needed to send one person to deliver one punch to an alien army to stop them, Derek Lewis might just be that guy to send. But it's pretty likely Daniel Cormier is going to out-wrestle him and kick him in the liver, in the stomach and put him away, and that is fine. But Cain Velasquez presents a significant challenge. The odds would be close. I think a lot of people may pick Cain Velasquez. And I guess if you're the UFC, you don't want to jeopardize that Cormier-John Jones fight, that Cormier-Brock Lesnar fight. So it's not as crazy as some of the other conspiracy theories I've heard in the world of MMA to think that the UFC is manipulating the situation and not giving Kane an opportunity. But I will say this much, Cain Velasquez is very much in the Tony Ferguson, Dominic Cruz category of I don't know if I would want to build a major event around this single fight, because despite it not being his fault, his body has failed him so many times in the lead up to big fights.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of, you know, just it's one of those things. Like I think about what happens if Brock never gets his situation, you know, multiple years ago. What if Kane stayed healthy? How would this heavyweight division be? Who knows? But you know, really one of the big storylines over the past couple of days, news stories, was Conor McGregor really breaking his silence, going on his Instagram page to give his thoughts on his fight with Khabib Nurmagomedov. Not going to sit here and read through the whole statement. I mean, literally, it's been on every MMA website, and I'll say this. I really don't care what Khabib's manager has to say about Conor McGregor's thoughts. I care about what Conor McGregor has to say, because as I was preparing for the show, that was like every lead story on every MMA website was, what does Khabib's manager think about what Conor had to say? But there are a couple things that stuck out to me about his statement about the fight. And I mean, look, you can sit there and say, you know maybe Conor's got some, you know, some blinders on some things that happened. But, you know, very early on in his statement, this is kind of what jumped out to me. He says, quote, after the shot, I bounced back up to engage instantly. But again, he dipped under to disengage. This is a sport, and it was a smart move that led to a dominant round, so no issue. Well played. If I stayed switched on him and give his stand-up a little, even a little more respect, that right hand never gets close, and we are talking completely different now.
I gave his upright fighting no respect in preparation, no Pacific stand-up spars whatsoever, attacking grappler slash wrestlers only. That won't happen again. I also gave up attacking grappling, no disrespect to defensive-minded lessons. And then, Daniel, the other thing that really stuck out to me was at the very end of this where he says, quote, I will be back with my confidence high, fully prepared. If it's not the rematch right away, no problem. I will face the next in line. So those are really the two things that jumped out to me. And I've always said this about Connor. Take away what Connor does in promoting a fight before the fight, because that's what he's doing. He's promoting a fight. He's trying to get people interested in watching him fight. The thing that I find most fascinating about Connor is after the fight and how he breaks down the fight. And I think this is another example of why I enjoy listening or reading Connor's thoughts after his fight is over, as opposed to what he's saying before the fight.
Yeah, it's interesting. It really is. He did put a high degree of detail there when it comes to just letting himself inside your mind. And that's something you appreciate. And there's something somber about it. I mean, the quotes that you mentioned are the ones initially that jump out to me. The most Connor quote in this whole thing is when he talks about round one and he's like, from a sports standpoint, round one was him. From a fight standpoint, the first round is mine. I'm like, no, it wasn't. I know it's not. I know. Getting a takedown and laying on top isn't necessarily something you see in the Roman age of fighting. But I mean, come on. Even from a fight standpoint, Khabib won on cards. All right. I know it's if it's a back alley brawl, hey, at least he's still winning. You know, if there were guys watching and judging. But yeah, that's the most Connor thing. It's like, Connor will never concede small points. He will always look to get it. But it's crazy to see him talk about the fight in terms of being vulnerable. The fact that the quote you mentioned, man, like the idea that he gave his Khabib's stand-up no respect in preparation is kind of a crazy thought on such a high-level fight. On a guy who Nurmagomedov maybe isn't known for his striking, but very clearly is a top-shelf striker in the UFC at this point. He has really honed his game, and we have seen fights where, with his wrestling, he has utilized his striking offense. And I know he's talking about attacking grapplers, wrestlers only, but man, the way Nurmagomedov has fought at times, it's more than just being an attacking grappler or wrestler. It is using the wrestling, but more importantly, being incredibly effective with just your striking offense and ending the story there. So that is crazy where he admits to maybe not preparing for the upright fighting like he should. And then the other aspect that was interesting in that same quote was talking about how he gave his attacking grappling no respect. And that kind of jives with my general opinion of the show. I mean, Connor's one of the best in the world, but in this fight, more than just the attack and grappling, the attacking in general felt lacking from the point of the fight starting towards the end. There were some moments, especially in the third round, where Connor looked great. But the big issue for McGregor when it comes to putting himself in the best position to win, having watched that fight and having heard him talk about it, is that I think his biggest issue was that he paid too much respect to Nurmagomedov just when it comes, Jason, to being aggressive. I don't think he went out there to look to implement his offense. I think he went out there looking not to lose and playing the defensive side of things against Khabib and Nurmagomedov.
Yeah, another line he had in this statement he put on Instagram that jumped out to me as well, and I think it really kind of makes you ponder, like, kind of what's Connor thinking that he's just not saying publicly. He said, quote, "Listen to nobody but yourself on your skill set. You are the master of your own universe. I am the master of this. I must take my own advice."
I will say this. If Conor McGregor leaves John Kavanaugh, that's like the stupidest move ever. Like, John Kavanaugh is the greatest. From all accounts, that guy is a great reality check. I feel like he is just does not care about the pomp and circumstance. I mean, that's who I'm thinking of when he says something like that.
That's exactly what I thought of. I was like, man, is Connor thinking about making, you know, some radical changes in terms of how he prepares for fights? I mean, that was the thing that jumped out to me. I mean, I was just like, wow. I mean, but once again, it just kind of it shows us a little bit about Connor's mindset. And the craziest thing about Connor is, if you look at what's happened with him over the last, 2 weeks or so, being at the Cowboys game and giving tickets away to the World Series, it seems like his star power has actually gone up. It hasn't gone down since his fight where Khabib. I kind of feel like the same. It's going to be interesting to kind of see when Khabib's next fight in the UFC takes place. Of course, we're recording this here on Wednesday morning of October the 24th. Later on this morning will be the Nevada Athletic Commission hearing in Las Vegas. Nothing's really going to come out of this hearing. Yes, Connor and Khabib are on the agenda, but this is just a formality of extending out those temporary suspensions, basically getting stuff on paper. Really nothing's going to happen for at least another month in terms of the disciplinary complaints. So, don't really expect much to come out of this hearing today. But it's with Connor, the star power is still big there. And of course, there's, at the very end of it, obviously he's conceding that, hey, I'm realizing the rematch is not going to be next for me. But I mean, there is still a lot of fights out there for Connor to make that are going to make him a crap ton of money. The Nate Diaz fight is the one that really sticks out to you, the fight that could make him a ton of money. George St. Pierre, I think, is the other fight that comes out there. I just, from the Khabib camp, I hope they realize that when the rematch does take place, they're still the B side of the fight. They're not the A side.
Yeah, that's totally true. Both guys are obviously gaining popularity, but again, Connor is definitely in another stratosphere. And that's the general sense I get too, Jason, is after this fight, his star has still brightened, which is a difficult thing to do in this sport. Well, it's a difficult thing to do in the sport of boxing, to lose and lose again and maintain your popularity. In MMA, I mean, fans are more conditioned to be accepting of losses. There have been plenty of stars who have lost. But, man, Connor has become such a megastar that it seemed in the preparation that winning or losing was life or death, but not really. Similar to the way Connor was a much bigger star coming off a loss to Nate Diaz, it feels that way with Nurmagomedov. I do think that there is a limit. I think if there are consecutive losses, like we're talking three losses in a row, I think that's when it becomes devastating. But at this point, Connor is such a major celebrity and such a part of culture right now that every time he does fight, it's going to be a record buy rate. It will be interesting how the next Connor fight does in contrast to Nurmagomedov, but there is a lot of opportunity there in the pay-per-view landscape. That's one of the big things with boxing moving out the pay-per-view landscape, with Canelo kind of moving out. There's a lot of money there that isn't being spent on pay-per-view because there just aren't any. So really any Connor McGregor fight maybe gets that money. I think people generally want to, a couple times a year, spend some money on a big event on pay-per-view. And, Wizard the Odds, the porno parody isn't cutting the mustard there. You got to go with a big fight feel. And it's kind of ironic where, it was a struggle for mixed martial arts to get on pay-per-view. And now it's like one of the last remaining strongholds of the pay-per-view market.
Yeah, we talked about last week, Canelo going to the zone. So, and it seems like you're seeing kind of a for the most part, boxing shifting away from pay-per-view, even though I did see this morning the Pacquiao-Broner fight is going to be a Showtime pay-per-view. I don't know how much that really is going to get people to fork over, how much money they're going to want. By the way, speaking of the zone, I tweeted about this yesterday. So I was going online to pay my credit card bill, and I see this charge for $11.31, and I'm like, what is, we all have that, like, okay, what is that? And then it clicked to me because I saw it was Performance Group US. I was like, oh, that's the zone. I was like, huh, it's supposed to be $9.99 a month. And so then I go on to my DAZN account, and what it is, yeah, you pay $9.99 a month, but then they charge a tax, which for me was $1.32, which I found pretty interesting because that's at a almost 14%, tax. I'm like, okay, I live in Florida. It's not, we're at a 7% sales tax. So I thought that was interesting. Kind of, people were kind of responding to it. People noting that ESPN Plus does the same thing where they charge tax as well. One person saying they actually pay $5.40, another person saying they actually pay $5.44. I'm guessing that probably somewhere when you sign up, it probably notes that it just slipped my mind. And in all reality, I really was going to cancel my DAZN because there's nothing over the next month that really, interests me. I mean, if the Israel car was airing live for Bellator on Thursday, November 15th, okay, then you got me sit there and have DAZN for another month. But that fight card, everything I've been told, is that it'll be simulcast at the same time it airs on Paramount, which will be about, a 36-hour tape delay, which, once again, just still amazes me that Bellator and Viacom and Paramount are still doing this to fans, but that's what it is. But I thought that was kind of, because with Fight Pass, it's $9.99 a month. There is no additional tax. So, and then when, like, I've bought stuff like, an in-app purchase on, like my iPad or iPhone, it's, hey, if it says, hey, this is going to cost $4.99, it costs $4.99. There's not, oh, by the way, there's an additional tax on top of it.
Yeah, that's a big tax. I'm interested in the details of how they deduced 14%. I mean, it's not the craziest thing in the world to charge, $4.99 and have some degree of a sales tax. That's not insane, but I will say, you're talking 14% of the sum here. We're over $11. That is sketchy. I am curious about the details because, even in the state of Texas, we have a higher sales tax than usual. I think maybe because we don't pay state tax. So it's like 7 or 8%. But 14%, I do wonder how they deduce that. DAZN being sketchy. I mean, don't get me wrong. Sales tax isn't sketchy, but my biggest red flag is how much the sales tax is, honestly.
Yeah. That was to me. I mean, I was like, and based on my previous experience with their customer service, I didn't walk away very impressed with it. And so it's like, hey, man, it is what it is. I mean, this is the thing with DAZN. It's ultimately is are they going to offer a consistent product that's going to get me to sit there and say, okay, I'm going to pay $9.99 a month. It's kind of the same thing we look at in 2019 of UFC Fight Pass. If they're going to continue being $9.99 a month, if you do a monthly plan, I said this to Joe on Twitter yesterday. I said, how does Fight Pass remain relevant in 2019? And that's, as I look at the MMA industry in 2019, that's kind of like one of the things that really sticks out to me is how will Fight Pass be relevant?
That's a great question. And it's something where Fight Pass hasn't been relevant in years, the way I feel. I just don't feel like Fight Pass has put cards on the deal that is appointment viewing. I think it started off strong, but it's just puckered, man. It's just gone downhill, downhill, downhill. And I think your casual fan doesn't think to subscribe to Fight Pass anymore. Maybe if they're stuck in the loop of just, they won't cancel their debit card or their credit card. But I just don't see much motivation to go and subscribe to Fight Pass until they do, unless it's a big month event where there's one or two fights on a fight card that really convince someone to subscribe. A lot of the content they're doing is fine. It's interesting. They're doing a lot of the documentaries for the 25 years of the UFC. That's great and all. And they're airing a lot of events from across the world. But when it comes to being relevant, it's all about that top 10% of what you offer. It's all about the live fights that you offer. And for Fight Pass, that just has not consistently been there over the past 16 months. And that's why Fight Pass is irrelevant. There are things you can do to revitalize it. But to be completely honest with you, I think it's a lost cause. I really do think UFC may have given up on Fight Pass, and they're just putting all their eggs and putting good content on ESPN+.
I mean, I've heard about the documentaries for the 25-year anniversary. I've heard they're unbelievable. I haven't had a chance to sit there and watch them. I'll be honest. Last couple weeks have been just really, busy for me. Yesterday was like the first time I got home like around like 4:30, 5 o'clock, and kind of was pretty much done for the day. I actually watched Joe Rogan's special on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, pretty good. I think he actually taped that, I'm guessing, right before the Boston show at the beginning of 2018. But I definitely want to check that out. I mean, look, the best thing I think Fight Pass has done in 2018, obviously, is the Dana White Tuesday Night Contender Series, but that's going to ESPN+. And, I mean, I haven't become an ESPN+ subscriber yet. Obviously, I will beginning of 2019. I do like the. I mean, if I was a bigger hockey fan, I mean, look, I love going to a Tampa Bay Lightning game, watching Lightning games. But in terms of the rest of the league, I'm not really tuning on. I mean, like I can watch a. I mean, look, I'm a big Magic fan, and hey, great win the other night against the Celtics. But basketball is one of those sports I can watch any team play. I don't have to have a rooting interest. Hockey, it doesn't really interest me. Baseball, no, it doesn't really. Football game, I'll watch any football game. I'll watch CFL. During this summer, I'm watching flag football, and I caught myself going, what is up with me? Why am I watching flag football on television?
I know, but I will tell you this much about MMA. Well, wait a second. I mean, I thought you were saying CFL, and I was calling, you got a problem. Flag football, you've got a serious problem. You need an intervention.
That's like in the month of like July with like your itch. You're like, you know, training camp's right around the corner. And I mean, I just remember it was like a Sunday afternoon. You know, I'm flipping through the television and it was NFL Network had flag football. I'm watching this and like, I'm like 20 minutes into it and I just go, am I seriously watching flag football?
There was a guy at the network that got a lot of crap for pitching that probably. There was a guy like, all right, guys, it's late in the year. Not much football, flag football. I'm like, get out of here, Brad. You're always out here with your outlandish ideas and well, they got your eyeballs. Yeah, but the cool thing is I would put MMA in that category of like you're flipping channels and you don't know anything about it, but you just stick. I mean, hockey might be like that for some people, especially because of how fast-paced it is, but baseball really isn't because it's so slow-paced. But the cool thing for MMA and the fight game is that when you kind of look at changing viewing patterns with how we consume anything, I think MMA still fits in that category that people still want to watch live. So that is kind of a cool thing. But yeah, I mean, ESPN Plus, I'm kind of confident that if the price point stays the same, the product the UFC offers is enough for me to feel good about purchasing the subscription service. Independent of maybe anything else I'd be interested in on there. So, it would be a funny turnaround, not maybe about ESPN Plus, but about ESPN when we're talking about Kane, is that if the first ESPN fight features Kane Velasquez. I've always, think of the way Fox started with Kane and JDS and how it's ending. You've already mentioned it. It's ending with, Ali Aquinta and
Kevin Lee.
So, I mean, it's a great fight.
speaking of Fight Pass, and this kind of came to my mind, I wonder if Fight Pass might try to say, okay, we know we've got to try to venture out to get fans to continue to get their monthly subscription. Makes me wonder if they try to get in business with these bare knuckle boxing promotions.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess that could be a way to go about it, but I also don't think that really does enough. But bare knuckle boxing's gotten some degree of attention. They have some former UFC stars.
I watched part of that event on Saturday night. A buddy had at his house. We were flipping around, and he ordered it. And one of my initial thoughts after watching one of the fights was, okay, there's no way a cable television company is ever going to put this on regular cable television. No way. We were watching a women's fight and the one girl was winning and the other girl comes back. And I mean, man, it was brutal. I mean, if you're looking for some brutal boxing, bare knuckle boxing definitely is for you. But I watched that. And I'm just sitting there going, man, there's no way bare knuckle boxing ever is going to get a network or a cable television type deal. I mean, that's going to be a pay-per-view internet streaming, format for forever.
And I guess it's an avenue you can go with. I don't think it's one that's going to work, but I guess it does have a higher degree of probability. But again, it's just, MMA fans want to watch mixed martial arts, and bare knuckle boxing is interesting. It is something similar in that MMA category where if it's on in a bar, I think it's going to gravitate a lot of attention. There's a lot of risk, though, of that being on in a bar just because, of it being on TV. Because again, when the way people play it, I think the likelihood of how brutal some of these fights can be is just too much.
Yeah, I mean, look, I do bar marketing, and I would never recommend that to my owner. I just wouldn't. I'm sure there's some bars that definitely would do it, but yeah, that's going to be a struggle. In terms of Fight Pass, I wonder maybe could 2019, could that be the home of the PFL? I mean, the PFL is we're now at, you know, onto the championship phase of this tournament. You know, this past weekend's PFL 10, I mean, it was a fight card that didn't really stick out to you, middleweights and welterweights. But as you look at now this championship card that's going to be on December 31st in New York City at the Hulu Theater at Madison Square Garden, card is going to start at 7 p.m. Eastern time, run all the way till 11 p.m. Eastern time. You know, the fight that, you know, in terms of what happened with the middleweight and welterweight, maybe Ray Cooper III is kind of going to be the guy that comes out of the season that maybe the PFL can develop into a little bit of a star here. But when I look at the championships, the fight that sticks out to me is Steven Silver versus Lance Palmer. By far, I think that's the best fight they have in the championship.
Oh, yeah, it really was. And I mean, when we were heading into the year, the featherweight tournament was the one that stuck out with the most talent. And it's paid dividends the way we are now. And I'm very interested in the way this fight card is lined up. Because if I was lining this fight card up, Seiler and Palmer is definitely the fight I would put in the main event spot. I don't know how they're going to do it. I think when you look at this lineup and when you look at PFL 10, you brought it up. Ray Cooper is the star. I mean, he's one of the few guys we have seen on these quarterfinal, semifinal shows that has gone out there and got back-to-back finishes. And not only back-to-back finishes, but back-to-back first-round finishes. I mean, he went out, destroyed Jake Shields, which wasn't the most surprising result in the world given what we saw in their first fight in the PFL season, and then destroyed Henderson Farah from top. So, I mean, Ray Cooper looks great. He, to me, is the breakout star of the year for PFL, but the most interesting fight, it's Seiler Palmer 100%. I'm really looking forward to this PFL 11, man. I mean, the fights aren't dynamite fights, to be completely honest with you, but having seen pretty much every second of the quarterfinals and semifinals, it does get you invested to see this thing out, to see Rashid Magomedov and Nathan Schull and Vinny Magalhaes and Sean O'Connell. But yeah, I mean, if we're power ranking the most interesting things of PFL 11, I think it's Palmer Seiler. I think it's Ray Cooper taking on Magomed Karamov, and I think it's watching Vinny Magalhaes attempt to finish things off against Sean O'Connell.
Yeah, when I look at the potential fight lineup we could see at the PFL 11, it wouldn't shock me Kayla Harrison's a co-main event.
I think she definitely is the biggest star on the card, so you have to do it. But yeah, I mean, it is like we are what? It's December 31st. I do wonder at what point we're going to get an announcement on who her opponent is. And I also wonder what options there are long-term of making interesting matchups. But for Kayla Harrison, I mean, as long as she's undefeated, I think she's going to get people to watch for sure. And I wouldn't be shocked if she's the co-main event, because to me, she's kind of one of the stars the PFL is building around and undoubtedly the biggest star they currently have.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, they've talked about, you know, doing a women's 155-pound tournament in 2019. And look, we've seen the struggles the UFC has had at 145. We've seen the struggles that Bellator has had at 145. You know, it'd be interesting to kind of see what kind of tournament feel that PFL can do at 155 pounds. I remember it was a couple of years ago, I heard about a promotion trying to put this 155-pound division in women's side together, but nothing ever came about it. But yeah, but PFL, I mean, it's I wouldn't say I'm all in on PFL 11. You know, I'm all in on Steven Silver versus Lance Palmer. That's definitely the fight that potentially could get me to the television set on December the 31st. But you know, outside of that, I don't know if there's a fight that says I gotta sit there and watch this fight card live.
Yeah, I mean, Palmer Silver is a great one. This isn't like appointment viewing television for sure. I'm interested, but it's not something I'm going to advertise. I'm not going to advocate for it because I feel super passionate, because, you know, a lot of the fights aren't amazing. They really aren't. Without the hubbub of being a part of a tournament, Philippe Lance and Josh Copeland wouldn't mean much on a random Bellator card. It really wouldn't. It probably wouldn't garner much interest, but we've seen these guys compete over the year, $1 million on the line, so I am interested. I mean, there wasn't – the middleweight tournament at PFL 10 was one of the weaker sides of the tournament, in my opinion, just from a product standpoint. I mean, Luis Taylor and Abusipian Magomedov didn't really go out there and make me, like, be like, I cannot wait to see this fight. I mean, Nurmagomedov really looked great in the headline fight, the semifinal fight. Dominated, in my opinion. But this is one of those contests where there have been times watching these PFL 8, 9, and 10 cards where I'm like, I cannot wait to see this fight. Not really the case here. Again, at PFL 11, Jason, it's not appointment viewing television. I don't think it's probably the peak they wanted, but I'm still interested. And I'm looking forward to seeing this, and I really do wish PFL success because I do like the concept of PFL. And maybe finding a home on DAZN, Fight Pass, ESPN Plus, or another streaming network is the best possible option for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that you look at with PFL is just, can they ultimately get people excited and get people to tune in? I mean, I think that's ultimately the big question mark for them. I mean, look, we want to see PFL succeed because it's going to be what is best for fighters to get there more, but it'll be interesting to kind of see whether or not people are kind of get all in on this. The television ratings at this point have not been very good, but that'll come up here on December the 31st. But coming up next, you're going to hear four interviews I have recently done. Up first, you're going to hear from Andre Sukumtha, of course, going to be fighting on Saturday at the UFC Fight Night card up in Canada. Beginning of the interview, talked about an article that was on UFC.com where, really he talked about that fight against Sean O'Malley. Then you're going to hear my conversation with Lewis Smolka, the former UFC flyweight. He has now won 3 in a row since exiting the UFC, so talk to him about his most recent win this past Saturday. Talk about how he's living a sober life and how that has changed him. Then you're going to hear my conversation with Weston Wilson, who's going to be a part of the Golden Boy MMA event coming up here a month from now on November the 24th. Then you're going to hear my conversation with Hillary Rose, who's going to be fighting on the CES card next week. So here's my conversations with Andre Sukumtha, Lewis Smolka, Weston Wilson, and Hillary Rose. Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a man that's going to be stepping back inside the UFC cage. Coming up here, UFC Fight Night 138 up in Canada. Andre Sukumtha, who of course has gone through an opponent change. Initially it was Gavin Tucker, now he's taking on Jonathan Martinez. Andre, as always, man, I appreciate the time. I was reading an article that was on UFC.com where you were kind of talking about everything leading this fight. And one of the quotes about what happened in the last fight really stuck out to me. You said, a lot of people made fun of me because of that, but I'm past all that now. I've grown a lot from that fight, and I've learned a lot from the experience. I probably needed it. It humbled me a lot, and now I'm back to my roots, back to the hungry Andre that I was before I got to the UFC. What stuck out to me, he says, I probably needed that. Why do you think that you needed that to happen to put you where you're at now?
You know, everything in the UFC happened pretty fast and fairly fast. All last year, I would say 2017 to 18, when I fought locally, the show was run different, but my focus was always the same. You know what I'm saying? No matter what happened, my focus was always the same because I had that goal of getting signed to the UFC. And then I found when I got there, a lot of things changed and I felt like my focus drifting on other things, but what was important, not only in fighting, but in my life. So that's why I say, I think I needed that. Because if I won, I would probably would have blown up and or whatever, but I would have won by just, standing up to a guy that had a broken leg, So then of course more people would talk, but I really needed to be grounded, and, forget about the media, forget about the cameras, forget about the money, forget about the fame, the popularity, everything that comes with it, and just focus on winning fights.
And I guess the other interesting part about this whole is the fact that you split your training, started in Florida, now up in Rhode Island for this one, and you talked about how you need to get back to your roots. So what was it for you? What was it something that shortly after that fight you kind of realized, hey, I need to kind of go back to where how I got to this point?
It's always been in my mind. I always think about it. Even before this fight, I always think it would be nice to go back home and do a camp over there, or at least do some training standing there because, you know, the people that I started with are all here. My strength and conditioning coach, my MMA coach, my boxing coach, and my father, who's been training me my whole career. So I finally put myself in that position. You know, I set things up the right way for my family so that they'll be okay when I'm gone for 5 weeks. Because, you know, I think, you know, most people know that I'm the guy that drops my kids off, that picks them up from school, that does all the daily activities, because my wife, she has a job. She has a great job, too. So, you know, it's a team effort. So when I'm not fighting, or even when I am in camp, when I'm not training, I'm driving my kids to school. I'm taking them to appointments. I'm doing all that stuff. So, you know, I made sure that home was all set. You know, we had some help, and I made the move, the transition to come up here and train for 5 weeks away from my family, actually away from my family for 6 weeks, just so that I can focus on just fighting. You know, there's nothing wrong with the training down in Florida. You know what I mean? I think it was just for me mentally. I needed to just get away and come back home to, you know, the people that go to sleep thinking about my fight and waking up thinking about my fight, rather than just being in a room full of killers and successful athletes. I needed more attention on myself, and that's why I came back to my old team the second part of camp.
Being away from your family, would you say that that's up there as maybe the biggest sacrifice you've had to make in your fighting career?
It's the hardest thing that I've ever had to do in my fighting career. Especially that my two kids are growing, and you know, me and my wife, we have a real structural way of how we do things at home, and we had to, you know, learn how to break that a little bit from me being gone. And we had a whole bunch of transitions. I just sold my house in Florida, you know, right before I got here. So it was crazy. We had to move out and, you know, get that stuff in storage. But I'm glad that we got all that out of the way. You know, it feels like I got here yesterday and already I'm done with camp today. So I think that it was the right move, and I cannot wait to show the world what I can do with this team behind me. On top of being at Hard Knocks 365 all year round, training there all year round, and then coming back home to my old coaches, I cannot wait to display the skills that I can prove next Saturday night.
With splitting your time between Florida and Rhode Island, what will the corner look like on fight night?
I'm having all my corners from Rhode Island. So I'm going to have my father, and my head coach, Dave Keefe, cannot make it, but he's been working with me hard, and it's okay. And my MMA coach, Pete Jeffrey, you know, he's from Triforce MMA. You know the guys that they train. They train a lot of CES guys, up-and-coming CES guys, Triforce MMA. Greg Ribello, you know, guys like that. So I'm going to have Pete Jeffrey, my father, and I'm going to have my manager, Tyson Chartier, who also has MMA experience, and he's not only a manager, but he's also a coach. So,
yeah, anyone that follows Tyson on social media, one of the things you'll find interesting is sometimes he'll put a picture of like this sheet they put together that essentially is the start of the breakdown of fighting someone, which is very interesting. And for you, of course, I mentioned you're supposed to take on Gavin. He pulls out of the fight. Frustration, would that be a way to describe it for you of when you get the call to find out that Gavin's out of the fight?
When I got the call, when my manager told me that Gavin was out of the fight, it was probably about 2 weeks ago, and I had just gotten done sparring, and I felt great. And I felt great this whole camp. The first week was really tough coming here, but then after I picked it up and got my schedule going, got my routines going, got settled, man, I was on fire. So actually, when he told me, I was like, okay, whatever, who's next? Who you got for me? As long as I'm fighting, you know? And they tell me it's a newcomer in Jonathan Martinez. And, hey, man, tough luck for him. He gets me for his UFC debut.
A solid record he has, 9-1. What's your general thoughts about him on what he's going to bring to you on fight night?
Of course, he's going to come and try to prove a point and try to take my spot. And I'm simply not going to let that happen. I'm fully focused on winning the fight, and he's going to sleep in the first round. I'm knocking him out in the first round.
Would you be disappointed if you didn't get that first round finish?
I'll get the win, but I will knock him out.
I mean, that's got to be – I mean, you obviously have been in the UFC for some time now. I mean, that first fight, I mean, do you at all think about what you went through in that first fight and like, okay, I know those are the feelings that he's going to have, and how do I take advantage of that?
Exactly. I've been there, and I've done that, and I fought Albert Morales, you know, who's another killer, and I took it real short notice. He had a little bit of time to prepare for me, and he's also a southpaw, like Gavin Tucker, so, you know, nothing really changed in practice. You know, we kept doing the same thing, and I trained to put somebody to sleep come October 27th, and no matter who it is in front of me, they're going to go to sleep.
Now, is this going to be your first trip to Canada?
Yes.
All right, yes, sir. Are you planning to stay up there and be in a little bit of tourist after, or is it, you know, hey, I'm getting back to Florida with my family?
I have a flight back at home, 9 a.m., right back to Florida. Man, I haven't seen my kids for 6 weeks. I'm going to be with my wife. I'm going to see her next week. Can't wait. But all I want to do is just win my fight and go home to my kids with a big paycheck in my pocket and take them on a vacation. And we live in Florida, so Disney World's there. There's a lot of things at Universal Studios, so I cannot wait to do that.
As a Florida resident who does travel a lot, the one of the weirdest things is if you travel from somewhere north where it's cold, and then you get off that plane in Florida, it is like a cold. It's like
that.
It's crazy. It's
the
like
palm trees, the water. It's the best.
I mean, I think it's like 80 degrees right now outside. It's crazy. I've lived in Florida all my life. In the past couple of years, it'll be like October, November. It's still like 80, 85 degrees. It's crazy.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I love it in Florida. You know, that's where we're based at. That's where the Sukumta household is based at right now. And even though I'm doing my camps up here, I think I'm still going to be living in Florida. So.
And, of course, we look forward to seeing your fight, which will be a part of the main card on FS1. Everyone can check that out. Andre, as always, man, I appreciate your time. And, of course, let everyone know where they can follow you out on social media.
Guys, please follow me. Please follow me on AndreSukMMA.com. You guys want some inspiration? You know what I'm saying? I'm just a guy from a small city that came from nowhere, and I ended up being the first signed UFC Laos fighter. And, you know, one of the guys that really blew up in Rhode Island. So follow me, man. Get some inspiration. Get some training tips. And I appreciate that. IG, baby.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a man that won the vacant CXF flyweight title this past Saturday night, Lewis Smolko. Lewis, I appreciate the time. Of course, if anyone has not seen the fight, they can go to the CXF Facebook page, go to the 2-hour and 45-minute mark. That's right when the fight starts. How would you describe the opening 5 minutes of that fight? Rough might be a good terminology to kind of describe it.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, he clipped me a pretty good one behind my ear. I was rocked a little bit, got the knockdown, but, you know, I kept my composure and just, you know, worked through it. It was a tough fight overall. I mean, I'm happy to get the win, but, you know, like him missing weight and stuff and getting to rehydrate early, that like definitely like kind of like compounded the problem, you know.
And, of course, you mentioned you survived. And then as the start of the second round opens up, did you kind of feel like he had kind of put everything he had into the first round and there wasn't much left in the gas tank for him?
My coaches kept saying, you know, he had cardio problems and, you know, he'd get tired down the road. So they really wanted me to push him hard. And we kind of felt like, you know, we felt like he was getting tired. We kind of see it, you know.
And, of course, dominating, overall, the second round that you had there, and then, of course, the ground and pound you had for about the last 90 seconds of a round or so. As the bell sounds in the second round, did you kind of feel like the fight was over at that point?
No, I was ready to keep going. They brought me back to the stool. I was ready to do it again, you know. I was ready to go out there and get on top again. But, yeah, they ended up stopping it. I was happy. I was relieved to get the win, but I was ready to keep going.
I mean, you know, he stands up and he's kind of stumbling. That's where the referee calls it off. For you, I mean, I have to imagine from a fighter's aspect, you don't want the ref to call it off at that moment, but do you also kind of understand why the ref made the decision he made?
Honestly, in the heat of the moment, I was just ready to keep going. You know what I mean? Like you go until they tell you to stop, you know? So, I was ready to keep pushing forward and keep hitting him. But yeah, looking back, with a clear head and stuff, I get why he did what he did, you know? Like, you got to protect the fighter. I had a pretty big round, you know, I was hitting him with, six punch combinations, you know what I mean, standing. And, I was just taking it to him on the ground. He was I saw his eyes roll, honestly, a few times when I was hitting him. But he would just try and, punch me back off bottom to kind of, just keep me at bay. But, honestly, I hit him with a few elbows. I saw his eyes kind of start to roll, so... I guess like thinking back, I'm like, yeah, I guess maybe it was good that he stopped it because it was getting kind of bad.
And of course, this marked your third win in a row here since exiting the UFC at the end of last year. How would you describe the last 10 months of your career?
It's been rough. At the beginning of the year, having to quit drinking and then being away from my wife and my kid for a while and then going back home to Hawaii, winning in Hawaii. And then, being to do my camp with my family again, that was nice. And then moving up here, it was kind of stressful. First camp was a lot, but, we got it done. And yeah, it's been a lot of work, man. But I'm happy, I'm fighting and I'm happy. I'm getting wins. So that's what matters.
I know, we've talked about, going to a sober lifestyle before, and I thought I was reading an MMA Junkie story where it was your manager, Jason House, that kind of had to, yelled at you and made you realize. And one of the things in the quote that really jumped out to me is that how you say you took things for granted. As you look back on that time now, is it just one of those, would you say it's kind of the biggest regret you've had in your career?
Yeah, probably just not taking things serious. Just kind of always assuming the UFC would be there and stuff. I wasn't really in love with it anymore. I'm not really sure at what point it happened, but there's a point where I wasn't going to practice to get good, to put the martial arts together to learn and to further my craft. I was going to to see how much I could get away with drinking and still make it through practice. I don't really remember when that happened, but it was my focus shifted and that wasn't good. That was not good. I mean, it happens, but I wish it didn't,
But you're obviously in a great position now. You're sitting there, you've won three in a row, potentially a UFC offer comes, or maybe Bellator looks at putting you on that fight card in Hawaii. I mean, kind of what is the thought process now for you?
I just need to get paid, Fighting outside of the UFC, it doesn't pay very well, or at least outside of bigger promotions, it doesn't pay very well, So I need to start getting paid. I need to just take big fights and, hopefully a big promotion wants, give me a shot. I'm down for Bellator or whatever, Risen, ONE FC, whatever. But just call me. Let's talk business.
I mean, obviously UFC, other promotions, 125 is clear there. Bellator, they don't have a 125 pound division. They'll do 125 pound fights here and there, but in terms of a champion, there is no title there. If a Bellator offer were to come, would you just make that leap up to 135?
I would just see what they wanted to do, if they wanted to build a division, I'd love to be a part of it. Or if they wanted, I would be open to moving out. But, I don't want to be fighting huge 170-pound off-season bantamweights, I've never been that big in my life, I'd like time to, work out, build the muscle, get some strength and conditioning in, maybe 4 or 5 fights in, I can start fighting some bigger dudes,
What's the biggest you've ever gotten fighting at 125 pounds?
I weighed 160 for a day once. That was a while ago. I'm pretty consistently around 145 now. So, that's fighting high-end bantamweights would be, they're pretty big,
You mentioned about how, you know, life outside the UFC can be tough, and that's not a news flash to anybody. But I've talked to, you know, guys who've made it to the UFC or maybe even the Bellator, and they'll get back on that quote unquote regional scene. They'll talk about sometimes it can be difficult to find fights. Has that been the case for you, or actually finding fights has been fairly easy?
I mean, yeah, it's been an issue, you know. Like when I first moved out here, like it took a while to get me a fight. It took like 4 months. I didn't even end up fighting the like intended opponent. I ended up fighting like a late replacement. Same thing with this fight. I ended up fighting like a late replacement, you know. My original opponent, Jared Papazian, pulled out like a month out. So, I mean, yeah, like, it's hard, you know. There's a lot of things that go weird here and there. My guy ended up missing weight, you know, so it's like, it wasn't really even like a real fight for me, you know. It's like, there's all this stuff just happening that's like just making things harder, you know. It just keeps compounding the problem.
Now when your opponent does miss weight, not just this situation but other situations, is there a point where you sit there and say, no, I'm not gonna fight this guy? Or is it like, no, man, I gotta get paid, I'm gonna, you know, I'm pissed off he missed weight, but I'm still going to go out there so I can get my money?
Yeah, it just depends, dude. It depends on how bad they miss by. I mean, I missed by like 4 pounds. That's pretty big. Like, that's getting to the point where you're like, that's like kind of the brink, you know. That's about as big as they can get before you're just like, all right, this, you didn't even try, you know.
Yeah, you've talked about in the past moving your training to California. What was the toughest transition of moving, you know, from one gym to another?
It was just a lot of logistics stuff. I mean, just shipping up, like packing my whole life into boxes, shipping it up, knowing where to ship it. You know, it costed a lot to ship everything up here. Getting my car ready to come up here. It was a lot, you know. But like, as far as like, I guess making the transition when I first came up here without like Yumi and Lucy, that was hard. Like being up here without my wife and my kid was hard. That was probably the worst part.
Yeah, I definitely think anyone who has kids can definitely sympathize with you there. But Lewis, I really do appreciate you coming on the podcast. Looking forward to seeing when that next fight may take place. And as always, let me know, they can follow you on social media. And if you want to mention some of your sponsors, go ahead, man.
Yeah, if you can find me at Last Samurai UFC on basically everything, IG, Twitter, Lewis Smoker on Facebook. Yeah, man. Just thank you to Defend Hawaii, milkandeggs.com, Lace and Loop, G Fuel Energy, Virus, Terp House. They've been supporting me. Terp House is an awesome sponsor, man. After that fight, first thing I did, CBD oil. Straight up, I was like, all right, man, I just got to drop. We got to take care of my head right now. Straight to the CBD oil. They don't play around either, man. 1,200 milligram drops. So I was like, oh, yeah, I'll be okay. I'll be just fine.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a man that's going to be a part of the Golden Boy MMA event on Saturday night, November the 24th in California. It's Weston Wilson. Weston, as always, man, I appreciate the time. It's been a little bit of time since we had a chance. We talked right before you had that fight for XKO, a great win for you there. You know, so, I mean, obviously you went back and you watched that film probably countless times. What was your biggest takeaway from that fight?
Yeah, so it's funny. We expected a grappling match. We expected him to come out and try to take me down. And we weren't sure if he was going to be able to bully me to the cage or not, because he's only 5'5", but like those guys can be stout and strong. His first kind of shot on me, I was like, oh yeah, no, he's not going to be able to take me down. And so from there, it was like, yep, I'm just going to establish my range. And I remember his corner saying, like, watch out for his front kicks. Watch out, because that's something I do a lot in my fights. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to fake him out, and I'm going to just throw hands. So I started throwing hands a little bit. And then I went back to the front kicks when they forgot about him. And that set up everything. And then, you know, I had Levi Miles in my corner, and I remember him saying, hey, throw your 3-1-2. And so I was like, all right, I threw it. And there it was. It was just the money shot right in his face. So, yeah, it was pretty cool. It was a good win.
When you hear your opponent's corner calling out a certain thing, hey, look for this, look for that, Do you take a mental note for after the fight and say, okay, is that a trend I'm showing in multiple fights?
Yeah, it's definitely and you know, after the fight, I had Jiva Santana in my corner, who's my head coach out here in California. And it's something that we kind of made note of, like, all right, you know, we went back, watched film, we looked at everything, and we kind of established, like, yeah, I'm showing some trends here. Like, we need to make it different, or at least set up different. And so, you know, I'm always going to stick to my core game, my fundamental game. But I just have to improve, like, my defense and expect their reactions. I'm still going to show my moves, hoping that they give me what I want and what I anticipate, as long as I can, you know, do something else off of it. I've got enough footage on me now to where people are going to expect me to do certain things, and I'm going to expect them to know that I'm going to do those certain things so that I can then add another layer to my game, if that makes sense.
The last time we talked was right before that XKO fight, and we talked about the move to California, and you know, Kiva, the arm collector, one of the yeah. trainings that. So has how have you and your family adjusted to living in California?
And my daughters love it. They love the beach. They love you know, just the weather, everything. My wife, she's loving it. We outside of how expensive it is. We love it. Like, California has got to be the most, like, $4 for a gallon of gas. Groceries are expensive. My rent is out of this world expensive, but I'm paid well. My company loves me. I love my company. I just got back from Korea and India a couple weeks ago, out there for work. Had an awesome time out there. It was a good time. I got to train a little bit out there as well. It's cool to kind of train in different cultures.
I was going to ask you about that. If you had a chance to go out there and train with anybody over there, obviously there had to be a language barrier. So how do you train with somebody when there is that language barrier?
You know, it's funny. I want to make a documentary. If any producers out there want to hook up, I have it all written out and planned, but fighting's a universal language. Like, there's two universal languages, love and fighting. Like, everybody understands love and fighting, right? And so, yeah, when I was in Korea, it was super hard. I was at Korean Zombies gym. He wasn't in that day. I guess I went at open mat time. But I went with his training partner, who was also a 45 pounder. And, you know, he didn't speak very good English. I didn't speak any Korean. But it was cool because we kind of had an understanding with each other and kind of knew what the other person was interested in the sport. And we kind of went away. We exchanged Instagram and social media profiles and follow each other now. I don't know, like, when you're fighting and training, because I started this in Brazil and I didn't speak any Portuguese, but, like, I understood everything that my coach was trying to explain to me, because, like, we all in our DNA understand fighting. Like, it's part of that natural instinct of being a human being. That was one thing. Like, I'd love to explore the world and see all the different cultures and see kind of why people get into fighting, but also kind of explore that idea of it being a universal language. Like, it's one thing that unites us as a human race, regardless of our culture, is fighting.
And as we're talking, we're 1 month away from this fight here at Golden Boy MMA. You did go through an opponent change, now taking on Leandro Gomes, 3-1, trains at Novo União gym down in Brazil. You know, obviously, I know this change just happened, so you're kind of gathering all your information. But as of right now, what are some of the things that stick out to you about him?
Well, so I think he actually moved up here to California. I think he's running the Kings MMA West Hollywood gym, from what I'm told. I'm told he's really well-rounded, Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. But I'll tell you this much. Like, I've trained with a lot of Brazilians. I started my career down in Brazil, Brazilian top team down in Sao Paulo. There's one thing I know is I have better wrestling than most Brazilians. That's not to say I have better grappling. I just have better wrestling. That transition from feet to ground, from ground to feet, I'm going to be better at. I'm also a lot bigger than this guy. They're making me cut down to 140. I had decided I want to be a 45er. The last fight, my last opponent was going to be at 155. So I'm swinging quite a bit of weight for this. But it's all good. Like I said, I'm a wrestler. I've been cutting weight my whole life. We'll make it happen. So striking wise, like I figure he's got that King's MMA style a little bit, which is good. I think I do well against that style of fighting striking wise. I just got to watch out for the blitz. But it'll be good. Should be a good, exciting fight.
What have you had to do differently to make sure you're going to be at 140 pounds? I mean, have you been walking around at a lighter weight, change your diet, a little bit of combination of the two?
So it's funny because when I was first contacted, it was like, hey, you're going to go up to 55 to fight Mike Segura, who's an interesting matchup for me because he's 6'2", I'm 6'1". It was going to be at 55. I fought at 55 before. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to put on some weight. Normally walk at 65, I'd put on 10 pounds. Then they tell me, hey, the change of opponent, it's going to be at 45. And I was like, cool, 45. No, I'm used to that weight cut. And then they came back and said, hey, do you want to do 140 instead? And I should have been like, hell no, I'm not doing 140. But I was like, you know what? I was like, at this point, like, I just give me a contract. Like, let's make this a done deal. So it's like, whatever, I don't care. And so now I'm like, I don't know, 5 pounds extra is going to suck, especially around Thanksgiving time. Luckily, side note, I hate Thanksgiving food. Not a big turkey guy. I like mashed potatoes and pumpkin pie. That's about it. So I'm kind of like, eh. It's more not being able to eat the Halloween candy that's bothering me than Thanksgiving.
Hey, I'm not a big turkey guy either. Pumpkin pie. Oh, I'm with you on that one. Love me some pumpkin pie. But yeah, turkey, I'm just not big on it.
Yeah, I can eat pumpkin pie at any time now. Like, from now until Christmas, pumpkin pie is going to be on the shelf. But, like, the whole Thanksgiving meal, like, I think last year I made my wife cook us a ham instead of turkey. So I was like, I hate turkey. So, missing out on Thanksgiving, not really a big deal. Friday will be weigh-in day. So my wife is not going to have me as a Black Friday shopping partner. She's going to have to do that on her own. But the timing of the whole event, it'll be good because I'll kind of get to celebrate the holidays after, and I'll keep myself in shape in case there's a short notice fight after that one as well. It'll be good to have just fought right before the holidays instead of having to fight during the holidays.
Do you have, obviously, this event headlined by Chuck and Tito? Do you remember? Like, do you have a memory of watching either one of their two previous fights?
Yeah, I actually, I'd watched both of those fights. It's funny. I wasn't a Chuck Liddell fan until I started training at the Pit Elevated because of Core and Chuck's relationship. We all kind of were like, not forced to like Chuck, follow his career. Actually my very first UFC memory was in 2001, Tito and Evan Tanner. I was like in sixth grade, and that was like my first, when Tito slammed Evan unconscious. And I was like, you know what? I want to be a wrestler. Like, that's kind of cool. And so that's kind of what started it all for me. And then I was in ninth grade watching The Ultimate Fighter and seeing Chuck and Randy and that whole like little rivalry going on. And that's when I was like deciding, I told all my buddies on the wrestling team in ninth grade, I was like, I'm going to be a professional fighter. Like, mark my words, I'll fight professionally. And so coming full circle and being on a card with Chuck and Tito is amazing, because those are two guys who really got me into the sport and interested in the sport. And obviously Forrest Griffin and Randy Couture, like, those were like the four guys that I was like, man, these dudes are awesome. Like, this is who I want to be like, and this is what I want to do. And so that's what got me hooked in the sport. So it's cool to like come full circle with it all.
And of course, everyone's going to be able to watch this fight card on pay-per-view. I know it'll also be on Fight TV as well. Weston, man, I really appreciate time. And of course, let everyone know where they can follow you out on social media.
Yeah, at Weston Wilson is my Instagram. From there, you can kind of find me anywhere. I also have a personal website, westonwilson.com. I post a little bit about business. I post a little bit about fighting, kind of marry the two together. So very cool website as well. And then on just every, all my social media is just Wesley Wilson. So not a super common name, easy to find.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a fighter that's going to be part of the CES 53 card November 2nd. It is Hillary Rose. Going to look good at 3-1 in her career here. Hillary, I appreciate the time. Short, you know, a little over a year now, pretty much a year, February would be exactly a year that you've been a pro. How would you describe 2018 for you in terms of making that transition into the professional ranks and to where you're at now?
I think it's been a really, really great transition. Turning pro, I had I guess not a long amateur record, but I had 8 fights. I was looking for 10 amateur fights. I wanted to have a long record, get comfortable in the cage. But the time was right. I fought for a belt, won a belt. I was nervous going into my pro debut. I mentally don't think I was prepared. I think I was physically and ready to go pro, but mentally just was nervous about the whole transition. You know, 5-minute rounds, it's, you know, a little more intense. The rules are a little different. So losing my pro debut, I think, taught me a lot of lessons about myself. And I've improved my game and my mental game in so many ways that I really enjoy being a pro, and I'm excited to have this career and to be fighting for CES again, and I'm excited.
Yeah, that number 10 is a number we hear a lot in terms of the amateur ranks. Why was, I mean, obviously you didn't get to 10, you wanted to get to there, but why is the number 10 such the, like almost like a magic number in terms of how many fights you want to have?
I don't know. I think it's a mental thing. Like, I think there was a lot of things in my amateur game that I never had like a brawl, like where I got beat up real bad, or the chance to like fight out of a submission or things like that. Like, I lost to a submission really quick in my second amateur fight, and like never had, you know, I never had too many like issues in a fight where I had to like really, you know, pull from my heart and like have to grind out a fight. So I think I was looking for that, not that I needed that. But it's a mental thing. I think that I probably could have had 4 fights and, you know, maybe have gone pro if I had, you know, whooped some ass and, you know, went 4-0. But I don't know. I think it's just mental and being comfortable in the cage and knowing that I'm comfortable and like aware of being in there.
Do you remember the moment when you were like, okay, I feel comfortable doing this?
Yeah, it was definitely my last amateur fight. Like, I always was comfortable in fights. Or I took about 1.5 years off. I had broke my hand. I had like a few injuries. And I fought Lanisha for Cage Titans. And I felt really comfortable in that fight. But then I fought for the amateur belt up in Maine. And I felt very aware. I could hear my corners. Everything felt really perfect leading all the way up to the fight, the camp, being in the cage, and just winning. I think that moment, and after the fight, my coaches said, you looked like a pro. Like, you went in there, you did everything you needed to do. You looked like a pro. And I think it's time to make that transition. And, you know, I have respect for my coaches. And if they believe that that's, you know, what I should do, then I trust their instinct and what they think is best for me.
And of course, you're coming off that win back at CES 51. You know, fairly quick turnaround for you here.
Yeah.
At CES 53. I mean, do you look at the quick turnaround is like, it's just basically, you're not necessarily in a training camp, you're just always training?
Yeah. I mean, I'm always training, but when it comes time to, like, training camp, like, I have a fight, we definitely focus on certain things, you know, build the fundamentals. You know, I like to better my own game. I mean, we focus on, obviously, the person who I'm fighting and what they may be good at, submissions or kicks, in ways I can defend myself, but I more so worry about getting better on my own and how I can, you know, outbeat them by just being better.
Has there been a moment, whether as a pro or amateur, where you felt looking back at the fight that you concentrated too much on your opponent as opposed to concentrating on yourself?
Yes and no. I think I'm comfortable in certain positions that may, like, I'm not afraid to have my back against the cage. And I think before I was able to like use more elbows and stuff like that in an amateur fight, it wasn't a dominant position for me to be in. Not that it's really, you never want your back against the cage, but there was times where I would back myself up and I'm like, I'm comfortable here. It's okay. But it's really not okay. you know, the judges look at that and they see if this girl's holding me against the cage, you know, she's winning, even if, you know, I'm okay or being, you know, offensive off that position.
And take it on Jenna here. I mean, they always talk about the challenges that, you know, a certain fighter may bring you that maybe previous opponents haven't brought you. Is there anything unique about this fight that's different than your previous fights?
I noticed that she throws, you know, really straight up the middle. A lot of girls that I fought before are kind of wild. Not maybe so much wild. Maybe they are technical, but they don't. She is a real good one, clean one, too. You know, she throws her cross real straight. So I know she's shorter than me by maybe like 4 inches. So I have a height advantage on her. But she definitely throws straight up the middle. And I know I can't, you know, let myself allow, even though I'm bigger and taller than her, get comfortable and, you know, bring my hands down, because I know she's gonna counter back quick. You know, I throw punches and she comes back relatively quick. So I haven't had a real good striking match, and I think that this fight might be that way. So we'll have to see.
Do you think she's fought anyone like you, though?
I don't. She fought a girl that I trained with, Kaylini, who's really great. I've gotten the opportunity to train with her, and Kaylini's a little shorter than me, but I really liked moving around with Kaylini, and we always had fun. So I think watching their fight and seeing how Kaylini fought and how I like to train with her, that I'm going to have, you know, a good dominant fight as well, just like Kaylini did. And I'll go in there and be comfortable and, you know, be able to control the whole fight.
You know, and obviously a win here, you know, moves you up into where you want to go. I mean, have you kind of mapped out what the next 6 months to 12 months is going to be like for you?
Ultimately, just to stay in shape. I you know, any opportunity could arise and anything could happen at any moment. So I'm always training and working hard and grinding it out. I mean, at this stage in the game, especially being a woman, you know, you never know when that opportunity could come, you know, any call or anything. So I'm just trying to stay ready and grind, and if that opportunity comes, I know I'll be ready because I'm always prepared. So
one of the things I always talk about in the fight game is the difference between perceptions and realities. There's perceptions people have that just, it's not reality. Is there anything you see as a fighter in general that perceptions people have that just is totally false?
I think people don't understand like the lifestyle of a fighter. Like, I think a lot of people think it's, you go to the gym, you take some classes, you hang out, you know, maybe you have to eat right and lose a little bit of weight, but it's a full, you know, you have to commit yourself, even if you work like a full-time job and you are a fighter. And, I mean, I have the opportunity to, I'm a full-time fighter. Like I, you know, work a side job to just keep myself busy because, you know, I can, like I want to. And, I'm a full-time fighter. Like I dedicate my life, you know, I'm constantly watching videos. I'm constantly drilling. I'm constantly hitting pads and, you know, focusing. I'm teaching, you know, teaching is what made me become a better fighter. Being able to teach others and teach kids, you know, it makes you have to rethink, you know, your fundamentals and how you can, if you can better somebody else, you know, you're bettering yourself as well. So I'm getting a lot out of that.
I've heard that from fighters a lot. Teaching a class makes you look at the how important fundamentals are. But when you're teaching a kid's class, is there ever a point where the child's parents have no idea you're a fighter and they find out you're a fighter? Has there been a unique interaction at that point?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them are surprised. I think a lot of people are surprised when they find out that I'm a fighter. But the parents are so amazing. Like a lot of my kids come to my fights and they all like rock the t-shirts and they stand there and the parents come to the fights. So even like, you know, young kids who are like 8, they're there cheering me on. It's really awesome. I see them all after. So having the support of the parents as well as the kids and them seeing like, you know, I have, you know, maybe 8 or 9 girls that I teach that come to my class. So I have like a class of 20, 22 young kids and a good amount of them are girls. And it's cool to teach them and see them grow and, you know, beat up the boys a little bit and, you know, have the boys bring it back to them and have like good competition and, you know, not raise, but teach girls that, you know, you can be strong and you can do any sport and be proud of that.
Is there anything the MMA fan would be surprised to know about you?
I don't know. There's nothing really surprising about me. No, I guess I'd have to think about it. I feel like a friend of mine would have to tell you that. Like, I wouldn't be able to think of something. Like, I like to sing. I write poetry, like, maybe because I'm so crazy minded, you wouldn't, and like, I don't know. Like, I write poetry and I sing, and that's probably about it. But I don't, like, share that with, like, people. It's, yeah, like, a, it's like my own thing.
Now, when you made the decision to be a fighter, were your friends and family shocked by that decision?
Yes and no. I think I started martial arts when I was 14. So I did Muay Thai for about 5 years before I started jiu-jitsu. And I did, like, a few smoker shows. But once I started doing jiu-jitsu and competing in grappling, I think my family knew that it was inevitable that I was going to get in the cage. And after my first fight, I was like, oh, I'm hooked now. So sorry, I'm dedicating my life to this. And they've been so supportive, my family and my friends. And I'm just so, so lucky of that. So it's not every day that your daughter wants to be a fighter. So
yeah, I gotta imagine there's definitely some parents out there that hear that. They're probably like, oh, I mean, are you sure you don't want to do something else?
Yeah, right.
But of course, everyone's gonna be able to see your fight here at CES 53, November 2nd. Of course, the event does air on Access TV. How can my listeners and watchers follow you on social media?
I'm on Facebook as Hillary Rose, Instagram Hillary Rose MMA, and Twitter. I'm just recently new to Twitter, so I'm figuring that out now. Is also Hillary Rose MMA. So find me, follow my gym, US MMA. You know, shout out to them. Matt Martin, Tom Hafers, they're big supporters of me, and Shane Doherty. He's preparing for his fight the day after me. He's a big important training partner to me. So definitely all of them. Follow all of them.
Hey, Daniel, there was my conversations with Andre Sukumthaw, Lewis Smolka, Weston Wilson, and Hillary Rose. Really kind of fascinating to hear Andre Sukumthaw talk about the whole Sean O'Malley experience. And, of course, you know, made some small changes. Spent the first half of his camp in Florida, last half of his camp up in Rhode Island, getting around, you know, people that he's been around his entire career. Then, of course, Lewis Smolka. Going to be interesting to kind of see, does he get a call back to the UFC? Maybe Bellator brings him in for the Hawaii event. And, of course, Weston Wilson going to be a part of that Golden Boy event on November the 24th. And Hillary Rose going to be part of CES 53. But I mentioned we've got the UFC Fight Night card coming up on Saturday night. You know, I'll say this. You know, I like the main event with Ozdemir and Smith. Obviously, a lot on the line there at 205 pounds. The rest of this card, man, it's I don't know if I would say appointment viewing television.
No, it's not. I mean, the main event's great. I love the poster. I love the way they promote it with the Vulcan, 15 seconds, fastest knockout, Anthony Smith, 22 seconds. But, yeah, the rest of the card doesn't really stick out to me. I mean, Lobov Johnson's a fight, I guess, and Misha Serkinov, Patrick Cummings. I mean, guys who desperately need a win in the light heavyweight division so badly. I mean, when I look at what really interests me, I mean, it's a fight like Nordin Taleb and Sean Strickland, and it's also a fight like seeing T. Edwards in the UFC against Don Madge. I think at lightweight, that'll be an interesting contest just because I think he's a pretty good prospect. He looked good on the Contender Series, and you know, he got in and out there pretty quickly. But yeah, when we're talking T. Edwards, this may not be the best card in the world, and I don't think that's the case for Fight Night. I'm looking forward to the main event, but this is not a card I'll be watching live. To me, when I just look at this card, it's just a lot of guys and females looking to get back in the good graces of their career, getting back on the winning track. They're in rough patches, and I think it's like the most evident in the Serkinov-Patrick Cummings fight.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I'll say about this fight card, I think the Johnson, Lobov, Vellante, Herman fight are likely fights that are going to be very fun and entertaining to watch. You know, how does Andre Sukumthaw bounce back now taking on Jonathan Martinez? Of course, we're supposed to take on Gavin Tucker. Tucker pulls out to an injury. Martinez now making his UFC debut. You know, Misha Serkinov versus Patrick Cummings. I guess the question for Misha Serkinov is can he stop Patrick Cummings from, you know, taking this fight to the ground? I mean, this is the thing about Misha Serkinov. I mean, you think it was not that long ago that he was a guy that we were all looking at as, man, this is a potentially one of the next title challengers. And you look at 2017, the knockout losses to Ozdemir and Glover Teixeira. I mean, let's not forget, it is almost 2 years ago of his last win, which I guess was against Nikita Krylov at UFC 206.
Yeah, man, he was one of those bright spots in the UFC light heavyweight division we were looking at. There were a lot of young guys at a point in time when, you know, the division was littered with old dudes, and still kind of is. But there were a lot of guys like, man, on the rise, Serkinov's going to be a title challenger. And you're right, he's just hit speed bump after speed bump, and now he finds himself at a drink a little bit, a crossroads, right? Like, he's got to win. He's got to win here to get back there. I mean, even a fight Nasrat Haqparast, that's a fighter I'm interested in. Just because, like, his first fight against Marcin Hell in the UFC, never thought much about the Afghan, but now you look at him in his latest fight, the last time we saw him when he went out there against Mark Diakis, a guy who I really think a lot of, getting the victory. I think Nasrat's going to have a pretty impressive performance against Thibaut Gauthier.
You know, going back to, you know, fighters against, you know, maybe having their backs against the wall, you mentioned Misha Serkinov. I think you have to put Patrick Cummings in that route as well. This is a guy that, you know, is 2-3 in his last five fights, lost against Corey Anderson, a little nog, Glover Teixeira, the wins against Blachowicz, which is a nice win, and a win against Volante. Both those wins coming by decision. The win against Volante, a split decision. The win against Blachowicz was a majority decision. So he's one guy that you definitely look at there. But in terms of this main event, I think it's a fight that we fully expect is going to be on the feet. Someone's going to get knocked out in this fight. You know, Volkan Oezdemir, you know, kind of, you know, obviously he's had his issues away from the cage that have, you know, had him, you know, forced to pull out of some fights due to visa reasons. So this is actually the first time he steps inside the competition since losing to Daniel Cormier back at the beginning of the year, which, DC, dominated in that one. But, of course, prior to that, we saw the knockout against Jerry Manawan, 42 seconds, the knockout against Serkinov in 28 seconds. You know, so he is a guy that you're definitely, you know, he's had this very fast rise at 205 pounds, and Anthony Smith, he's had a very fast rise at 205 pounds since moving up to 185 pounds, kind of a little bit of a poster child of why you should sit there and not cut massive amounts of weight. When you look at, since Anthony Smith has come up to 205 pounds, the knockout against Rashad, the knockout against Shogun, both, over the past couple of months. I mean, this is a guy that you look at since he has come back to the UFC, very quietly he's put together, this great run. And like what we mentioned about Serkinov a while ago, Anthony Smith is that guy you look at as, man, do we maybe have some quote-unquote young blood at 205 pounds?
Oh, totally. I mean, there's a lot on the line here in this main event, especially for Anthony Smith. I mean, the 30-year-old is a guy where a victory over Volkan Oezdemir, I mean, he's definitely not the favorite to get a light heavyweight title shot, but it's just so important for him to continue to go up those rankings. And I think you look at a win over Volkan Oezdemir, Anthony Smith's going to find himself number 6 or 5th ranked light heavyweight, maybe even number 4. He's going to move up the rankings because he's taking on a guy who's considered to be number 2 in the division. And if you actually do the analysis, I mean, he's number 3 just because, I mean, John Jones supersedes him by a lot. But this is what you would put Volkan over Jones?
Well, no. What I was thinking is if Anthony Smith wins on Saturday night, I've got the fight I'd love to see.
What's that?
How about Anthony? And maybe it would, you know, make Anthony Smith happy because I'm sure he'd want like a number one contender fight. But I just think from a entertainment aspect, how about him and Dom Reyes?
Oh, that'd be a great fight for the fans. It really would. I mean, that would be a tough fight for both guys. I think Dom Reyes would probably win that fight. I'm just so high on him. I mean, Anthony Smith, I mean, he's not a guy who's in a marquee spot. He's not going to pick and choose. He's not a Conor McGregor type, Jason. Whoever the UFC gives him, he's going to fight. I would love to see that fight a whole heck of a lot. I mean, Anthony Smith in this run has made a career out of being an underdog and not only winning, but getting the finish. So I would love to see that one. That one sounds awesome. The thing about Smith is he has become a very interesting fighter. He's become someone every time he fights, you want to watch him fight. I mean, I think the Volkan fight is going to be great. I think he's going to beat Volkan Oezdemir. And one of the big issues for Oezdemir is the layoff. I mean, having not fought since January really worries me. And it's almost like I have this weird feeling if it's like Cinderella at the ball, you know, the pumpkin or whatever. I don't really know the whole Cinderella story, but I think it's something like time happened and then like the thing turned to a pumpkin. I don't really know Cinderella. All I'm saying is it felt crazy watching Volkan Ozdemir win in the UFC by a lot against Jimmy Manuel Serkinov and OSP. It seemed so different than the Ozdemir we saw fight in Bellator. So my general point is the fact that he's been here, gone for so long, maybe he's reverted back to, you know, the old Volkan Ozdemir, and Anthony Smith's still hot. You know, his hands are still warm from beating Shogun Hua. And I think that to me is the general motivation for me thinking Anthony Smith's going to win this via first round knockout.
Yeah, Anthony Smith, by the way, is the betting underdog as of recording this show, plus 170, Volkan minus 200. I'm like you. I like Anthony Smith in this one. I you know, with Volkan, I mean, you think about kind of the crazy rise he had, has had in the UFC. I mean, you think about that fight against OSP. That wasn't exactly a fight people are going to go back and watch.
No, it's not a. It's not going to make the UFC Fight Pass, you know, best of collection of the company's history. I mean, it's not a great fight. And you know, Volkan has really accomplished a lot. I mean, this guy, that fight sucked, but he really has done a complete 360. I mean, people know how to say his name. And that's not maybe something that I expected. I mean, he got a title shot, which is just a crazy move going from the fact that, you know, when he debuted as like a 230 underdog against OSP, and since then he's just been an underdog literally in every single fight he's had up until this UFC fight against Anthony Smith. This is the first time in the UFC Volkan Ozdemir has not been a dog.
Yeah, I mean, as we both said, we both like Anthony Smith. The co-main event, of course, Michael Johnson steps up on short notice to take this fight against Artem Lobov. Artem Lobov, maybe another guy who knows, could a loss here mean the end of his UFC career? You know, probably not, just because of his relationship with Conor McGregor. But you know, since Artem came into the UFC in late 2015, you realize that all of his fights have gone the distance?
I did not realize that at all. I feel like he's one of those. I mean, and he's had what, like six fights? I feel like he's one of those guys that you know, when you think Lobov, you think the stand-up, and it's pretty interesting, pretty fun, but, you know, getting thrown in there with Alex White, Ryan Hall, or Chris Avila, you think at one point Lobov would get a finish. And the problem for Lobov is I don't think he's going to get that here against Michael Johnson. I mean, the fight might end, but it might not be the way he wants it to end.
No, I mean, look, I think this fight has a potential being a very fun fight. Artem Lobov, 2-4 in the UFC. He enters this fight following back-to-back losses against Andre Feely and Cub Swanson. Now, Michael Johnson, he's coming in on this fight following that split decision win against Andre Feely. That win snapped a three-fight losing streak. I mean, you look at Michael Johnson's recent run that he's been on, you know, where he's 2-5 in his last seven fights. It's like, man, look at some of the killers he's fought. I mean, yeah, 2-5 is not a great record, but you mentioned Elkins, Gaethje, Nurmagomedov, Diaz, and Dariush are the losses. And I think we do kind of forget one of those wins, Dustin Poirier.
Yeah, and I mean, the win prior to that was Edson Barboza. But at that point, we are getting back in 2015. And Michael Johnson really put himself in a position to get those big-time fights with four consecutive victories. And by the way, let's not forget the fact of how he entered the UFC, or not entered the UFC, but later on he ended up beating Tony Ferguson. So Michael Johnson has plenty of impressive names on his record. The win streak he went on earlier in his career put him in big-time fights, and unfortunately he failed time and again. This isn't a big-time fight for Michael Johnson. So as long as he maintains any degree of how he used to fight, I think he's going to come out here and look great. I mean, the last time we saw him fight against Andre Feely, it wasn't a Hall of Fame performance out of Michael Johnson, to be honest. It wasn't something where there have been a lot of times in that last run of some of his fights where he did look like a special type of fighter, a guy who improved so dramatically from fight to fight. And there has been some stagnation there. General theme of his career is there are peaks and valleys, and he's able to string together and piece together momentum. And in this fight against Artem Lobov, it presents a great opportunity to have a a standout highlight type performance, because by all intents and purposes, Michael Johnson is a major favorite in this fight. He has displayed a much higher degree of talent in the sport than Artem Lobov thus far. And this is probably going to be entertaining regardless, just because both guys have entertaining styles. But Michael Johnson does need to go out here and look impressive.
No, no question about that. He has to go out there and put together a big win. And you mentioned about some of the fights on the undercard that you're looking forward to. I think one of the fights I'll point to is I'm interested to kind of see Calvin Kattar, a guy that I followed over the past couple of years. How well, does he do against Chris Fishgold in that one? T. Edwards is a guy I've had a chance to interview a couple times. He'll be a part of the feature prelim. But outside of that, not too much else sticks out to me.
Yeah, I like the way you labeled it. It should be called UFC Fight Night Back Against the Wall, because that's how it feels for like every fight. Court McGee back against the wall against Alex Garcia. Misha Serkinov back against the wall. Ed Herman back against, like, that could be every fight's theme, to be completely honest with you. I guess the other fight we have mentioned, like Alex Garcia, Court McGee, I'm down for that. I think Alex is similar to a lot of these guys, trying to return to form. A guy who looked like a mini Hector Lombard early on, and now he's taking on Court McGee at welterweight. And, it's a fight. But again, the general takeaway here, Jason, is there's only one fight to watch here. Johnson Lobov's interesting. And then I think the general game plan, if you're a casual consumer of mixed martial arts, is just see what people are talking about post-fight. And then go and seek it out.
Or if you're up late on Saturday night, turn on FS1 about 12:15 a.m. Eastern time, and you'll be able to see the main event between Volkan Oezdemir and Anthony Smith. Now, Daniel, I did want to end the podcast this week by discussing a tweet that came out this week, and a fan tweeted at Ben Askren saying, quote, "Are you going to fight in the UFC, mate? Can you give me a percentage on it?" Ben Askren responds 98%. So we're only going to have one buy sell this week, Daniel. So are you buying or selling Ben Askren fights in the UFC in the next 6 months?
I mean, maybe he's trolling, but I'm buying. If it's 98%, Jason, I'm no statistics major, but that seems incredibly likely. That's crazy, though, that he threw that out there.
Oh, man, I hope we see Ben Askren in the UFC. I mean, this is, and just from a pure fan aspect of wanting to see the best fight the best, would love to see it. I mean, look, just my perception of the situation, I don't think Ben Askren fights unless it's in the UFC. I mean, look, there's a lot of interesting fights, I think, that are out there that they could do with Ben Askren. But I hope if it does happen, hopefully he gets a nice little payday. We saw Eddie Alvarez this week come out, talk about the payday that he's getting from one championship, which, makes you wonder if they're paying him all that kind of money, how are they going to make back that money? It's something very interesting. But, man, I just hope we see Ben Askren. And I can only imagine what the trash talk would be like if something, a Ben Askren, Colby Covington fight came together.
Oh, that'd be a great trash talk. The fight itself, probably not a fight of the year contender. But Ben Askren, I would love to see him in the UFC again. It's like one of those things where, you don't want that what if of what if Ben Askren fought in the UFC. I want to actually see it happen. And again, just one of the best wrestlers in the sport's history. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And again, in a fight against Colby Covington, I think that's a fight Ben Askren wins, both in the pre-fight hype and in the actual contest.
By the way, something to mention about Saturday's UFC fight card. They're going to go with the three-man booth of the play-by-play, and I'm actually kind of interested in hearing how this kind of works out. So your play-by-play guy is going to be Brennan Fitzgerald, but your color guys are going to be Jimmy Smith and Dan Hardy. I'm really interested to hear Jimmy Smith and Dan Hardy just talk about the fights.
Yeah, I think generally all those guys you have positive feedback on. I mean, Brennan, he always stays out of the way. He's probably a guy most people can't name, which is always a positive for your commentator, because that means you're staying out of the way, not being annoying. And then Jimmy Smith, Dan Hardy, two great color commentators. So I think this could be a great broadcast.
Yes, that'll be on Saturday night. That's the UFC Fight Night card. Of course, by the way, the TV prelims are on FS2, your main card at FS1. It's just a little well-rounded fight tip for you. If you're going to DVR these fights, you know, when you tape those prelims, you might want to put an extension of about 30 minutes or so, maybe an hour on FS2. Well, and also taping on FS1, otherwise you could maybe miss the opening fight of the main card in case the program before on FS1 happens to go over. So just a little tip there for the fight fan, Daniel.
Love it. Love the tip, Jason. And yeah, next week we're on the pod. We'll be talking UFC 230.
And along with talking UFC 230 next week, already got interviews lined up with Montel Jackson, who's going to be a part of that UFC 230 fight card. Also be talking to Canadian prospect Anthony Romero. Had him on the podcast. He's got another fight in the King of the Cage, and also trying to lock up some other interviews for next week's edition of the podcast. Of course, appreciate everyone taking time to listen to this podcast. If you're not subscribing to this podcast, do that on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play. Be sure to rate and review. Really appreciate if you do that as well. So let's go wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast, which comes out every Wednesday on RadioInfluence.com.
This is a Rush the Field quick fix on Radio Influence.
The biggest news around the college football world last weekend, Chris, was the stunning upset of Ohio State at the hands of Purdue. Now, I say stunning because Ohio State was number two, but in my mind, it really wasn't that stunning. I expected Purdue to battle hard with them. And of course, everybody asks the question, Chris, what happens now with Ohio State's chances to make the college football playoff? I'll tell you right now, it doesn't mean much because, say, one loss Ohio State team probably still has a great chance to make the playoff. But what I wanted to ask you, when you watch this game on film, what concerns you the most about the way that Ohio State played against Purdue and West Lafayette?
Their lack of a running game. Threw the football 73 times. You see somebody throw the football 70 times, they're usually on the losing end. They're struggling.
But was that by design, or was that because of what Purdue was doing?
I think it was going into the game. I think the flow of the game dictated, but they got too far away from the running game, in my view. That was a problem. I think they got behind a little bit, and that just precipitated the need to have to, we've got to chase, we've got to go. And obviously, to me, the game went differently than I ever anticipated, because what I thought was going to happen was, hey, Purdue's going to score points on Ohio State, because I've seen Ohio State struggle defensively with all their injuries up front. And I said, Purdue's going to score a lot of points. But Ohio State can match points with Purdue, and they'll win by outscoring them. It didn't happen that way. Mm-hmm. It was a combination of, I think, Ohio State not being able to keep up points-wise and getting away from the run, which contributed to their problems on the defensive end. On the defensive end, I thought they played way too much man. I thought they got sucked in and the jet sweeps. The safeties were responsible for the jet sweep, and the linebackers were a little too crowded towards the line of scrimmage. And I thought they got washed up a little bit in some of the misdirection run game for Purdue.
Rush the Field with Scott Seidenberg and Chris Leary can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.